And that takes us, Darren, to the Battle of Britain.
Hi, back again. The Battle of Britain. Okie dokes. It's the one major conflict of the Second World War that I don't think there's a single person on Earth who hasn't seen footage of it in one form or another. It's the most glorified battle of the war. Even if you're not British, it was definitely rammed down your throat at some point. It was from July to October 1940. So once again, just to mention at the beginning of this segment, because he's mentioned it before, the collapse of France stunned the world. People were sort of walking around in a painful fog, as Quigley says. They really just couldn't believe it. It was it had happened so quickly. And that's, I suppose, when things became really real to a lot of observers. It wasn't recognized at the time, but it was Britain's determination to go on fighting. Whereas Hitler himself, from what we have just learned, was under the opinion that Britain would seek peace. Hitler, up to this point, had surpassed his own expectations, and he was left with the, in air quotes, you know, what to do next. And he didn't really have a lot of information on his at his disposal, with regards to what he could do, or even the preparation needed to carry out whatever his plans would be. By the way, the Battle of Britain, it was known as Operation Sea Lion to the Germans. Hitler could. This is the thing. Here's another little oddity, is that Germany or Hitler, he didn't have to invade Britain. He didn't have to go through all that trouble. He had at his disposal the ability to effectively blockade Britain. So if Germany had concentrated on building submarines, the newly acquired U-boat bases in Norway and in the Low Countries and in France might have made it possible to blockade Britain into surrender. But Hitler rejected this plan. Instead, he ordered an invasion of Britain, Operation Sea Lion, a project in which no German, not even Hitler himself, had much confidence in. Then it goes on. At the same time, Britain's refusal to make peace revealed to the full the inadequacies of the French armistice. Hitler sought to remedy these by a project to capture Gibraltar, known as Operation Felix. Sea Lion and Felix required Hitler's active attention from July to November 1940. In the first half of December, Hitler put Sea Lion and Felix aside and replaced them with two new projects. The new project sought to conquer all of the Balkans, and we picked it up in the next subsection, and to attack the Soviet Union, which is Operation Barbarossa. And these went into operation the following year, April, June. Hitler's change of plans in December 1940 was a consequence of four influences. It was by that time clear that Sea Lion could not be carried out. Franco's refusal to cooperate had made Felix impractical. Mussolini's foolish attempts to conquer Egypt and Greece had opened a hornet's nest in the eastern Mediterranean. There was growing tension, much of it in Hitler's own mind, between Germany and the Soviet Union. As we learn later on in the chapter, the Mussolini, he was a real clown of sorts that Hitler just couldn't take seriously at the end of it. Old Mussolini really gave poor old Hitler a headache. The Operation Sea Lion was beyond Germany's strength, but no one saw it at the time. It required, as a first necessity, air supremacy for the Luftwaffe over southern England. Following this, the invasion would require a large flotilla of invasion craft to carry men and supplies across a lengthy stretch of water and to assemble these forces in combat formation in England. The German Navy was in no position to defend such a flotilla against the British Navy with minefields, and to preserve both the invasion flotilla and the minefields by German air superiority. Britain had adequate manpower, including the men evacuated from France and thousands of anti-Nazi refugees from overrun countries, but had little heavy equipment and certainly had only a fraction of the 39 divisions the Germans estimated to be the size of the defensive forces. So Britain hurriedly prepared, placed barbed wire and mines on the landing beaches. They had watches stationed everywhere, even took down the road signs, which might help an invading force find their way around. All able-bodied men, many armed only with fowling guns or birding guns, were drilled for defense against parachutists. Fortunately, none of these defensive measures ever had to be tested because Germany was unable to win air superiority over England. So it ended up being a poor decision by Hitler, as Britain was adequately defended. They had enough they actually had enough manpower ready for the size of the country. They had a really powerful air defense, and as we'll learn, they were ahead of the game with regards to technology. The Germans, going into the Operation Sea Lion, they just had too much to contend with at once from the British. And despite what you might have concluded about the British armed forces, they were a very formidable force. They were professional and they were a very active empire. So their armed forces, although Britain always tended to play it down, Britain were very secretive about their successes and what they did, but they had a very good, well-run defense system. So from the July the 10th, the Luftwaffe bombed, and this lasted till the end of October. They attacked coastal defenses and Royal Air Force installations. However, it is pointed out that Germany suffered severe losses to their air force. Quickly points out that British counter-offensives were very effective, and hundreds of invasion craft were sunk to the loss of all the men on board. Toward the end, the Germans shifted to night bombing. It was a very, very destructive, with a great loss of life. So the calm courage, as Quigley writes, and methodical devotion to duty of the average Englishman ended Hitler's sequence of diplomatic and military victories and inflicted on Nazi Germany its first and decisive defeat. The successful defense of Britain, forcing Hitler to give up the project for invading England, was the turning point of the European war. Coming as the first year of war was ending, a year in which Hitler had achieved unprecedented conquests, it ended any possibility of a short war and forced the Germans into a long struggle for which they had neither plans nor resources. It's interesting that they didn't have plans to go further than this, really. The defenders were victorious in the Battle of Britain for six chief reasons. He goes on to point them out. So number one, the indomitable spirit of the English people put surrender out of the question. Two, British planes were equal in number and superior in quality to the German planes. You normally hear via documentaries that the Germans had better planes. This is at odds with that. Number three, British pilots were of better quality and with better fighting spirit. Once again, you tend to hear that it was the Germans that were the better pilots in some of these documentaries. Number four, the British operational organization was far superior. Number five, fighting over their own land, British pilots could usually be saved by parachuting. And six, British scientific inventions were far ahead of those of Germany. This sixth point is of a vital significance. And that brings us to the topic of radar. Anyone that's seen the documentaries on the Battle of Britain would know all about it. But essentially, radar was being experimented with from as early as 1924. So that's a considerable amount of time before its war application. It was adapted for air attack in 1935. And by 1937, Britain had a chain of radar stations around the country, which was able to detect aircraft to a distance of 100 miles away or 160 kilometers away. What they then were able to do was to transfer the radar technology directly to fighter planes with radar detectors capable of detecting aircraft 3 miles away. So to the great bewilderment of the Germans, they were able to shoot down German bombers at night. And these Germans had no idea where it was coming from. The British had the edge when it came to technology. So they were able to shoot down German bombers at night. Plus, anti-aircraft guns were given radar aiming devices. And as quickly mentions, statistically, they were able to increase the takedown of enemy aircraft up to fivefold, which is absolutely enormous. So let's see here. So all this led to more effective night bombing raids on Germany later on in the war. So before this this period, generally bombers would fly across their targets and let rip, but approximately 90% of bombs tended to miss their target and land harmlessly in fields. And surprisingly, very few people actually were killed by these bombing raids. But by the end of 1942, the accuracy was enormously increased. And from early 43, radar was even adapted to see a target through the clouds. And then you have the well-known bombing of Dresden. So all that accuracy, it was so good that they were able to create a firestorm in Dresden, where the fires were just so powerful, it created its own weather system around the city, at which then sucked in fresh air from the countryside, superheating the city. So it wasn't just a raging fire, it was almost like being in a furnace. And the suffering of those people is hideous when you look into it. A lot of people actually died of suffocation because the heat just sucked up all the oxygen out of the breathable air. Truly a human tragedy. It finishes off by saying, as we have already indicated, bomb damage, however great, had no decisive effects on Germany's ability to wage war. But the growing effectiveness of British and American bombing made it necessary for Germany to devote increasing amounts of its resources and manpower to air defense and to production of fighter planes, and by drawing German planes back to Western Europe from Russia, aided the Russian defense considerably. So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. As we learn later on in the chapter with regards to the invasion of Russia, you know, Germany unfortunately ended up fighting a battle, a war of attrition on two fronts. So you could see how he had to shift resources and planes and various equipment back and forth. So the next section deals with the Mediterranean area and Eastern Europe, June 1940 to June 1941. Let's see. I'll read the first bit. The collapse of France had a shattering effect on the Soviet-German borderlands. From the Baltic, that's up there, that's Estonia, Lithuania, down to the Aegean Sea, down to Greece. In the week following June the 15th, 1940, the Soviet Union sent peremptory notes to Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, demanding that their governments be organized to include persons more acceptable to the Kremlin. Since Soviet armed forces were already there, and no hand of assistance was raised anywhere, least of all in Berlin, the Baltic countries yielded to the Soviet demands in the first week of August. The three new governments held elections, in air quotes, in typical Soviet fashion, with only a single list of candidates. The newly elected parliaments at once sought and obtained union with Soviet Russia as socialist Soviet republics. And then we move down the line to Romania. So down south, due to the Soviet threat, King Carol of Romania, he sought to align himself with Hitler because he no longer could count on assistance from the French, through Syria, because unfortunately the French had been defeated in France. So he had to go with the devil, the better the devil you know. Romania sought to align itself with Germany, and the rationale was that Romania had oil fields that Germany needed, and Germany also couldn't let those oil fields be taken by the British. So it thought that if it cooperated with Germany, it would be protected from the Soviet Union. So they broke their neutrality. Let's see. So there was an agreement made on the 26th of August, and Hitler summoned the Romanian leaders to Vienna. And in the presence of Count Ciano, I think he was Mussolini's advisor, and representatives of Hungary, they forced Romania to give 2/3 of Transylvania to Hungary. In return, Germany gave Romania a guarantee of its new reduced frontiers. This Vienna award, it really ruined things for poor old Romania, because after 1919, Romania had actually grown its frontiers from three different nations around them. They had gained territory. It ended up being a terrible result for Romania, because at the end of it, they lost all of that territory. It says the Vienna Award destroyed the forces of moderation within Romania. Riots and assassinations became a regular method of domestic political activity. These were instigated very largely by the Iron Guard, a reactionary anti-Semitic political group which had been in a quasi-civil war with the Romanian government. So they ended up chucking out King Carol and installing his son Michael. That little rebellion was put down 2 days later under indirect German pressure. Southern Dobruja was yielded to Bulgaria. Thus, in the space of a week, the territorial gains of Romania that they had made at the expense of three of her neighbors in 1919 were largely cancelled. Moscow protested against the Vienna Award on the grounds that it had not been consulted and that no guarantee of Romania by Germany was necessary. These protests were rejected on the basis that Berlin had been informed of various Soviet activities with equally small notice, and that the guarantee was necessary to forestall any possible British attack on the Romanian oil fields. So we learn then that Germany moved into Romania and at the same time began a military occupation of Finland. That's the timeline there. So Hitler had been so convinced that Britain would make peace that he had neglected these items. These items were the two items that are listed here is that Mussolini's jealous determination to obtain some glorious conquests in the Mediterranean to match Hitler's impressive victories in the north, and two, the complete inadequacy from Germany's point of view of the terms of the French armistice. By these terms, neither Germany nor Italy obtained any units of the French fleet, any naval bases in the Mediterranean, or any parts of the French overseas territories. On June the 24th, when the armistice was made, Hitler had been so convinced that Britain would make peace that he had neglected these items and had rebuffed Mussolini's efforts to include them. So within a month, Hitler recognized this error and demanded from France extensive military and naval bases and transport facilities in North Africa. These demands were rejected by Petain at once. Quickly mentions that Hitler didn't really have any real interest in the Mediterranean area. He had hoped that it would be quiet. His personal belief, as soon as the invasion of Britain became remote, was that Britain wished to hold out until the Soviet Union became strong enough to attack Germany from the east. And it says there's no evidence that the Soviet Union had any plans to do so, or that it was in communication with Britain in such a project, however remote, or that Hitler was afraid of Russia. On the contrary, the Soviet Union became, if anything, increasingly cooperative toward Germany, especially in the economic sphere, and by May 1941 was almost obsequious. All efforts for improved Anglo-Soviet understanding were rejected until after June the 22nd, 1941. And Hitler, far from being fearful of the Soviet Union, despised it completely and was convinced that he could conquer it in a few weeks. We go on to learn from quickly what finally motivated Hitler to make his move on Russia. His decision to attack Russia first stated on July the 29th, 1940, and issued as a formal directive on December the 18th was based on two considerations. One, only by destroying Russia and all Britain's hopes based on Russia could Britain be forced to ask for peace. And two, the Soviet cooperation with Germany was Stalin's personal policy, which depended on his life. In other words, only Stalin could guarantee it. Once, if Stalin died, there was nothing for Germany to depend upon. Hitler, although he wanted things to be quiet in the Mediterranean, it was just not to be. He had a very annoying partner in the form of Mussolini, who had his own particular demands and goals to for fame and power for Italy, more his own personal ego. He ended up poking the hornet's nest in that he decided to attack Greece, much to the irritation of Hitler. Germany, okay, the Mediterranean was not going to leave Hitler alone. Right. So, in spite of Hitler's desires, the Mediterranean era could not be kept quiet. The inadequacy of the French armistice, Mussolini's demands for a more active Mediterranean policy, British naval successes against the Italian navy, and Admiral Raeder's warning that some defensive measures must be taken to avert any American intervention in French Africa, all these kept calling the Mediterranean to Hitler's attention at a time when he wanted to concentrate on how to attack the Soviet Union. So poor old Hitler had to now concentrate on the Mediterranean issues before he could really focus his attention on Russia. On September the 27th, 1940, Germany, Japan, and Italy signed a military alliance. Okay, so that's when it was formally put into play. And this was to deter America from the war by giving the isolationists the upper hand with the elections of the United States. So he was essentially trying to scare the U.S. into adopting or continuing with its isolationist policy. Now, the Soviets were not trusting of this pact, which led to a turning point in the Nazi-Soviet collaboration. And we go on, we learn about a meeting between Molotov and Ribbentrop with regards to trying to sort out this the Soviet German relationship. So despite Spain promising to assist Hitler to take Gibraltar and the Suez, nothing came of it. Hitler was quite bitter about that, and I forget what he said now, but he basically was just given a promise and nothing else. So what led Hitler's commitment to the Mediterranean was, okay, about the same time in September 1940, under pressure from pro-German collaborators led by Laval, Marshal Petain, this pressure forced him to remove Weygand from his post as Minister of National Defense and sent him to Africa as coordinator and commander-in-chief of the French colonial possessions. Fearful that Weygand might cooperate with an American landing, Hitler, at the middle of October, began serious efforts to settle the Western Mediterranean situation once for all, in cooperation with Vichy France and Franco-Spain. In anticipation of such an attempt, Britain, in July 1940, had attacked and largely destroyed the major vessels of the French fleet at anchor at Mer el-Kébir and at Dakar, West Africa. With somewhat greater skill, the French units at Alexandria, Egypt, were demobilized by agreement. These British attacks on French vessels and subsequent Gaullist attacks with British support on Dakar and elsewhere were probably unnecessary and served to drive the Vichy regime into the arms of the Germans. On June the 24th, 1940, the French Navy had been ordered to scuttle its vessels if there was any chance of their falling into the control of foreigners, be they German, Italian, or British. The fact that Britain killed 1,400 French seamen by bombardment of anchored vessels greatly increased the normally anti-British bias of the Vichy regime and made it possible for the most anti-British members, such as Laval or Admiral Darlan, to eliminate the more moderate ones, like General Weygand. I don't know how you say that. So we learn that Mussolini went ahead and acted against Greece, despite Hitler's confirming with him that that wouldn't happen. That was too late. And so now we learn a little bit more about Mussolini. On page 701, he just couldn't get anything right. He was basically a clown, thirsty for some success to console his wounded ego. The Deuce of fascism decided to attack Greece. The German military occupation of Romania was the final straw which broke his imperious patience. Essentially, Hitler, from then on, started treating Mussolini like a subordinate. It was the end of the partnership, in a sense, of equals between the Germans and the Greeks. You had the attack of the Italian forces on the Greeks, which began from Albania, October the 28th, and it came to a stop within 3 weeks. And the Greeks, their counterattack carried deep into Albania, and Greek pressure continued throughout the winter. If you look into the activities of the Greek army in World War II, they were actually very impressive. They didn't really have a lot of resources, but a little bit like Finland, they punched admirably above their weight. So as promised in the guarantee of April 1939, Britain joined Greece against Italy. And nothing really came of that initially. Further down on November the 11th, 20 British planes made a torpedo attack on the chief units of the Italian fleet. So the poor old Italians just were pretty poor at warfare. Let's just put it that way. Then again, the British struck Graziano's forces, a huge loss for Italy. And further on, the Italians were beaten again at East Africa and Ethiopia, and 100,000 Italian troops destroyed by a British imperial force, and those British troops only lost 135. So the old Hitler was dealt a really lousy hand, having Mussolini as a ally. The Italian failures in Greece and Africa, along with Franco's refusal to attack Gibraltar, forced a considerable rearrangement of Hitler's plans. In the space of 2 weeks, December 7th to the 21st of 1940, Franco flatly refused to execute Operation Felix. That's the taking of Gibraltar. And accordingly, this project was cancelled. Italy, they had the nerve to ask for German and Bulgarian aid against Greece. The Nazi-Soviet rivalry in Bulgaria and Finland came to a head. And three new war directives were ordered by Hitler: Operations Attila, Marita, and Barbarossa. So Operation Attila, that involved the occupation of all of Vichy France. And Germany had had enough of Mussolini, the clown, and sidelined him, treated him as a, not as a partner, but as a subordinate. So I've covered that already. So essentially, Italy was a military basket case. Early 1941, German activity in the Mediterranean was very successful. It seems every time the Germans started any particular military activity, it was very successful. Ground and air was very, very successful, but Britain was able to get the ascendancy at sea. Around this time, it was when Rommel arrived in North Africa, and he also got off to a blistering start against the British. And he was able to do this because the British had, in error, moved into Greece. And it was against good advice given to them by the Greeks. In the meantime, Ribbentrop was engaged in involved diplomatic maneuvers. The Tripartite Pact of September 1940, in spite of Russia's suspicions, was really intended to frighten the United States to abstain from interference in the tumults of Eurasia. So in order to strengthen this, Ribbentrop tried to get Russia to buy into the Tripartite Pact. And a Soviet-Japanese non-aggression pact, which would free Japan in Asia to allow it to strike southward against Singapore. These maneuvers were a disaster for Germany. Futile efforts to obtain Soviet adherence to the Tripartite Pact merely succeeded in revealing the bitter German-Soviet rivalry in Bulgaria and Finland. While the successive Soviet-Japanese Non-Aggression Pact of April the 13th, 1941, made it possible to withdraw Soviet troops from the Far East in sufficient numbers to save Moscow from Hitler's attack. So, Ribbentrop basically stuck his foot in his own mouth. He ended up really assisting Soviet interests strength in the war. During Molotov's visit to Berlin on November the 12th to the 15th, Germany offered the Soviet Union a worldwide division of spheres. It goes into detail here, but rather, you know, simply put, the partnership would be made between them, and they would both benefit by splitting the loot of the world, territory, etc., all the way to dismantling the British Empire. And Ribbentrop did his level best to get the Soviets to buy into this scheme, to which Molotov was completely disinterested in. I think he called it a grandiose scheme. Instead, he wanted specific, concrete answers regarding Germany's presence in Finland. Going on, the Germans evaded Molotov's questions and proposed, in turn, a five-point plan of power and influence. So the Germans, Ribbentrop, gave Molotov a five-point plan, to which Molotov himself replied with a five-point plan of his own, which included the 5 points from Ribbentrop. Essentially, these 5 points were, somewhat to the expense of Germany, which really favored the Russians. And this sort of insolence, in a sense, if you can call it that, really enraged Hitler. And this was the point of which he must have really committed to invade Russia, because 4 weeks later, he issued orders for Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia, which was a joint German-Finnish-Romanian attack. But before this invasion could happen, the British had to be driven out of Greece, which was Operation Merita, to prevent the British bombing the Romanian oil fields while Germany was invading Russia. So it's quite complex being a seeker of world power. All these irritating anomalies pop up against you. So October 1940, Germany moved into Romania. Later, Bulgaria joined the Tripartite Pact. Germany then invaded Yugoslavia. And this, they resisted for about 6 weeks. Eventually, they yielded on the 25th of March, getting favorable concessions for themselves in the process. There was a coup in Yugoslavia, which they overthrew this German regency. You know, just 2 days, they installed a head of state by the young King Peter. So this new government that rebelled against the German regency signed a treaty of friendship and non-aggression with the Soviet Union on the night of April the 5th to the 6th. Less than 6 hours later, Belgrade was subject to a violent bombardment from the Luftwaffe, and 33 German divisions began to invade Yugoslavia and Greece. Both countries were overrun within 3 weeks and were divided up among the jackal collaborators of Nazi Germany. So there we see from the Baltic down to the Aegean, the Germans eventually sealed that area up, which gave them the needed protection or security to enter Russia unhindered. During this invasion, Germany kicked the British out of Greece, and the British suffered severe losses. The only plus was that all this delayed Hitler's advance into Russia, and it put an end to air raids for the foreseeable future on Britain. The Balkans and the Greeks proved to be very resistant, forming guerrilla groups which drained the Axis strength. Simply put, the Greeks fought very well. I'm going to leave it there, Melissa. Would you want to hit the next section?
Yes, I will do my best to just zip right through American neutrality and aid to Britain. What we find here is that the American opinion after World War I, the fact that they really didn't get involved in the League of Nations, they are geographically removed from Europe, and they just don't want to be involved in a war. They were determined to stay out. That's the public opinion. But what we know is that public opinion is always orchestrated by propaganda, and people in power will move public opinion where they need it to be. But what we have are two strong groups, isolationists in government, isolationists and interventionists, and the American public is really more on the side of staying out of the war. Now, Quigley describes Roosevelt as being careless about his committee. This was a committee to investigate the role played by foreign loans and munition sales to belligerents in getting the United States involved in World War I. So Quigley describes Roosevelt as being careless by allowing two important figures on that committee who were isolationists, Senator Nye and I don't remember the name of the other fellow, but anyway, you've got isolationists there. I wonder if this was carelessness, but at any rate, that's what you have. So this committee is showing that, yes, the foreign loans and munition sales had to belligerents had something to do with getting the U.S. involved in World War I. So they don't want to repeat that. So the isolationist point of view is what has formed statute law in the U.S. at this time. And they have something called the Neutrality Acts. And it says here, the isolationist point of view had been enacted into American statute law, not only in the 1920s by restrictions on contact with the League of Nations and other international organizations, but also later in the Roosevelt administrations in the so-called Neutrality Acts. These misnamed laws sought to avoid any repetition of the events 1914 to 1917 by curtailing loans and munition sales to belligerent countries. Now, it said that they were these laws were initially enacted in 1935, but they were revised 2 years later, provided that export of arms and munitions to belligerents would cease whenever the president proclaimed a state to be a participant in a war outside the Americas. So it had to be in the Americas. There had to be that threat. Any materials, including munitions, named by the president had to be sold on a cash and carry basis. So the country coming to the United States had to have the cash to pay for it, and they also had to have the ships to carry it away. Now, this reminded me of that Baruch book that I had read, Mr. Baruch. And he writes, or the author writes, as for neutrality, there ain't no such animal, Baruch said. for all the outcry over the so-called Neutrality Act, Baruch was convinced the United States did not want to be neutral. It just wanted to keep out of war. It did not want to give up its profits and its property. It did not want to surrender its rights to the freedom of the seas. It had already picked its side. It just did not want to fight. But if Americans' fears were roused sufficiently, Baruch knew they would fight. What then was true neutrality? Baruch's idea was as realistic as it was cynical. Why should not the United States keep its own ships off the seas and sell goods to any country that could pay cash and take them away? This was not only neutrality, in that it theoretically would treat all nations alike, but it was profitable neutrality. This was the idea called cash and carry, which Baruch was asked to explain to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on April 6, 1939. And it's interesting because Baruch doesn't really factor into Quigley, his writing at all. His book, he mentions him later as a appointee by Truman for an anti-nuclear committee. I don't have that name in front of me. But Baruch was very key. He ran what was the equivalent, I don't remember the name, but in World War II, the first inception of it was the War Production Board. And Baruch had been, he was a speculator, Wall Street investment guy. He had been the one that ran the World War I equivalent of that. And this is a key appointment because it said what commodities could be used, how things would be rationed, when the military or an allied force said they needed something, it would be one of these boards that would decide how much of it they could have. So Baruch, at least his biographer, is claiming that the whole cash and carry thing was his idea. Now, he's called in front of this committee, and it got kind of ugly. His character was called into question. Did he make money on World War I? He was offended. No, he did not. He was a patriotic person, etc. So he spoke before the committee and said, it's easier to proclaim neutrality than maintain it. He warned, to embargo the sale of implements of war under conditions that now exist might be the means of cementing into power the stronger nations and reducing weaker nations to slavery. In modern war, there was no distinction between life-giving wheat and death-dealing guns. He sat down and the cross-examination began. Senator Borah led off. Mr. Baruch did not contend that this cash and carry plan was a neutrality proposition. No, sir, Baruch answered promptly. Well, don't you think, the senator continued, when two nations are engaged in war, we ought not to sit on the side and furnish the instrumentalities? So what the senator said is, don't you think that's a bad idea to just be sitting it out and but giving them what they need to wage war? And Baruch snapped back. He said, well, then perhaps we ought to embargo everything. And the senator said, well, I am in favor of embargoing everything. Stolidly, he forced Baruch to agree that the cash and carry plan would benefit Japan or any aggressor who had the sea power to carry the stuff away. He said, we know that what we're doing is taking sides with the stronger cause. And Baruch persisted. He said, as soon as we treat them other than alike, we are declaring an economic war. Maintaining the status quo was neutrality. What Baruch wanted was all-out military production on the part of the United States as the surest guarantee for keeping out of war. But the president was reluctant and Congress was reluctant because to the people, arms meant war. So, like I said, it's interesting because Quigley doesn't really get into covering him very much in here or this key thing. This board that he was supposed to be involved in. But in when you look at Bernard Baruch on his wiki page, it said that Roosevelt wanted him in 19. First of all, they approached him in 41 to lead this war production board. That didn't work out. So they put somebody named Donald Nelson in, who incidentally ran Sears Roebuck for years. And he wasn't doing a good job. And so in 1943, Roosevelt again invited Baruch to take over this war production board. But his political advisor, Harry Hopkins, who was accused repeatedly of being a communist, said no, that would make him look weak if he fired Nelson in the middle of the job. But why I'm stressing on it is, in war, who decides who gets what and how your resources are used, both internally and then either sold or traded to another country? This is a very key thing. Eventually, Roosevelt was able to move things his way a little bit when Roosevelt was a Democrat, but he brought in two interventionist Republicans to his cabinet, Henry Stimson and Frank Knox. And that started to turn the tide a little bit. But Roosevelt's main goal was to educate the American public that they couldn't stand alone and isolated. So what another word for education is propaganda. This would come back to bite him, but Roosevelt's campaign, when he ran, one of his campaign promises was, no, we will not send our army, navy, or air forces to fight in foreign lands outside of the Americas, except in case of attack. Now, that's very important because, remember, we know that, there was some advanced knowledge of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, but that's his campaign promise. And then he said more emphatically, I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars. So there's campaign promises. But the fall of France prompted a buildup of the American Army and Air Force. And slowly, and we have to think that people like Baruch, and I'm sure there were other advisors in the private sector who were saying, you've got to turn private industry towards war production. One Quigley writes that, if I can find it here, in addition to the reluctance to expand capacity, both industry and labor were reluctant to convert existing equipment from peacetime production to war production at a time when government spending was creating a level of peacetime demand and peacetime profits such as had not been known in many years. Businessmen accepted war contracts but continued to allocate capacity, materials, and labor forces to civilian products because they were more profitable and they satisfied old customers. And it said this.
Has the broadcast switched off, folks?
Hi, I think it's come back. I lost you for a minute there, Melissa.
Did you? Where did you lose me? So what I was saying was that the American people did not want to go to war, and private industry had been told that they did not need to turn their attention yet. They were being encouraged to start to produce wartime products, but they were, I think I read a little bit here that Quigley was saying that it was more attractive to business to keep producing It said, in addition to the reluctance to expand capacity, both industry and labor were reluctant to convert existing equipment from peacetime production to war production at a time when government spending was creating a level of peacetime demand and peacetime profits such had not been known in many years. Businessmen accepted war contracts, but continued to allocate capacity, materials, and labor forces to civilian products because these were more lucrative. So there was the combined propaganda campaign to make it seem like that this would be a good idea not to be isolationist, combined with getting the private industry to produce more war materials that was going on in the background. But you also had people remembering loud and clear Roosevelt's campaign promises when he said, we will not send our army, navy, or air forces to fight in foreign lands outside of the Americas, except in case of attack. And then later he said more emphatically, I've said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars. So this is a background, and Roosevelt's goal was the education, which is propaganda, to educate the American public that they could not stand alone, isolated. So the fall of France prompted the buildup of the American Army and Air Force, and slowly industry was turned to war production. There was talk of the need to raise an 8 million man army. That's in the U.S. That's just huge. And then there was Roosevelt proclaimed a limited national emergency. This was to give old destroyers to Britain in exchange for 99-year leases of naval and air bases in British possessions from Newfoundland to Trinidad. So we're slowly starting to give things to allies in exchange for something in return. And then Roosevelt delivers his famous Four Freedoms speech, and this is part of moving the American mind to a new way of thinking about what's going on in the war. And the opening of Congress in January 1941, Roosevelt stated these kind of new aims of America's foreign policy. This is the Four Freedoms speech. He said, America was looking forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms: freedom of speech and expression, freedom of every person to worship God in his own way, freedom from want, freedom from fear. And he came up with some of the phrases were included, America as the arsenal of democracy. And, you know, arsenal, that's a good munitions, weaponry kind of word. But it starts to plant the idea in the minds of Americans that we're going to do everything that we can to supply armaments and essential supplies to countries who are resisting the aggressors. And the other key thing that was going on here was the Lend-Lease program and the introduction of the Lend-Lease Act. So this is December of 1940. Roosevelt gives this kind of homey, aw-shucks kind of speech where he says, you know, if my neighbor's house catches fire and I've got some garden hose, I want him to take the garden hose and put out his fire. And I'm not saying, hey, neighbor, that garden hose cost me $15 and you're going to have to pay me $15. He says, I don't want $15. I just want my garden hose back. So in this way, he introduces this bill, H.R. 1776, and became law later as the Lend-Lease Act. And the Lend-Lease Act was basically what it sounds like. We're going to loan you what you need. We're going to lease you what you need. And the payment can be made to the United States by any payment or repayment in kind or property or any other direct or indirect benefit the president deems satisfactory. So it's very open idea there. And then they get the war industries logjam opened up by the introduction of something called the Victory Program in August of 1941. And this Victory Program was that they wanted to achieve three basic things. Civilian production must be curtailed to provide labor, materials, and capital for war industry. And the second item was any adequate war industry requires a great increase in investment in new industrial capacity. And the third idea was that economic mobilization is impossible unless there's some degree of centralized control by the government and some degree of duress on business, labor, and consumers. As part of this Victory Program, Roosevelt set up the Supply Priorities and Allocations Board. And I just thought that these were worth mentioning because that board was set up in 1941. It was dissolved 5 months later. And this is where we bring in Baruch and the War Production Board and so forth, because they brought in the it had a different, yet another name, but eventually it became known as the War Production Board. And this determined who got what in terms of resources. And it rationed gasoline, heating oil, metals, rubber, paper, plastics. And this board was run by a guy named Edward Stettinius. And I just found this, I'll take a really quick side trip here, but this little Stettinius was fascinating when I looked him up this morning. He had been running, he was running the War Production Board, and then later he ran the Lend-Lease. And his father, also Stettinius, worked for J.P. Morgan during World War I. And when he was working for the banker, his job in World War I was to coordinate the purchase of war supplies for allies. So it kind of runs in the family. And then his father went to work for the War Department when the U.S. entered World War I. His father also ran the Diamond Match Company, which wasn't just a maker of matches, but they did, you know, they were into forestry and rubber. These things are essential for war. And just as another total little aside here, the Diamond Match Company was purchased by James Goldsmith in 1982. And James Goldsmith is the one who wrote the book that Alan mentioned a lot called The Trap, which was on the dangers of the pursuit of the free trade agreement. I also, about young Stettinius Jr., the one who ran the war board during World War II, he was a member of something called the Seven Club, which was a University of Virginia secret society. Seven is three plus two is seven, and you've got the 3-2-2 with skull and bones. So, but I kind of dug in deep to the whole Stettinius line this morning, and it's fascinating because the family still exists and they're still in Washington, D.C. So finally, Churchill and Roosevelt meet. Quigley says the Prince of Wales, other places it says they met on the USS Augusta. I think that Churchill came in on the Prince of Wales and Roosevelt was on the USS Augusta, and they eventually got on the Augusta and had what they called the Atlantic Conference. And this is mentioned on page 17, and anyone who wants to read this in detail to find out that it was a little bit of a disappointment to Churchill because he wanted more of a commitment right away from the U.S., but this Atlantic, I don't recall what they call it, that came out of the conference, if it was a declaration or charter. I think it might have been a charter. But it did lay out quite a bit more involvement from the U.S., and it bolstered U.S. idea of that they were involved in something for, you know, for the general public. And it also was that closer ties thing between the U.S. And Britain. And one thing that is interesting here is that as much as the U.S. kept saying, oh, we're not in it, we're not in it, we're not doing anything here, one thing that one outcome of this Atlantic conference was how the U.S. became involved in providing naval escorts to British convoys. And they couldn't sell it to the American people that they were going to escort the British all the way home to the safety, because then they'd be sending American boys to foreign shores, when you've got a president who says, we're just doing this, you know, we're defending our country and North America, et cetera, et cetera. So it appears that one of the clever ways they get around this little hiccup is they declared Greenland to be part of the Western Hemisphere and began construction of bases there. And we don't really have time to get into it, but the history of Greenland is quite fascinating. If you go back far enough, you see that that there's a lot of record there of the mini ice age. And that right there is worth investigating in the face of the global warming outcry. But it was always something that was under the control of Denmark and Norway when Denmark and Norway were unified. And then later it was just under Danish control. In the 30s, the Norwegians had just shown up there and claimed an area. They called it Erik the Red Land, I think. So the Americans essentially decided that they needed Greenland. They needed to build an air base and a naval base there, and they did. And I read in looking at it this morning that Donald Trump tried to buy it back in 2019, and it's still up for discussion. So it's obviously an important thing. But so the American people think, oh, well, we're not involved. And quickly said, many of the activities of the American Navy in the summer of 1941 were known not at all, or were known only very imperfectly to the American public. And by November the 13th of 1941, the Neutrality Act was repealed, and so we're positioning the U.S. to get off and running here. And I think that will do it on that section.
Thanks, Melissa. I'll try and end off strongly. I think my brain is falling asleep on alternative hemispheres every now and again, so I'll try and finish off strongly. So the last portion of the chapter is the Nazi attack on Soviet Russia in 1941 to 1942, and just to point out from the very beginning, it was a dismal failure for Germany. It ended up with Germany having to fight a war of attrition on two fronts. One that they were retreating on the eastern side with Russia, they were being forced back, and on the west. And Germany just could not cope with that. And so, as we've learned in the beginning of the chapter, you know, the war's divided into three periods. It's the Axis powers aggression. And then the second portion of it was the balance of powers. And so towards the end of the Nazi attack on Russia, we get to a period where the balance of power starts occurring. So his attack on Russia, Hitler really did assume that using the same pincer movements that he used in Poland, that he could take Russia down very, very quickly. I think he expected it to go just in a few months. It was customary German strategy concepts, which gave priority to the destruction of enemy armies over the seizure and occupation of enemy territory and resources. This destruction was to be achieved and quickly achieved, according to Hitler, in a series of gigantic pincer movements of the double arm type, which had worked so well against Poland. So the double arm pincer is an outer pincer and an inner pincer. The outer pincers are made up of armored divisions. That would be your tanks. The inner pincers would be your infantry. So while the armored pincers would surround enemy troops and enclose them, the infantry columns would then come in and slice up the enclosed mass of enemy forces into smaller masses willing to surrender. And it was incredibly effective. It worked overwhelmingly well. Germans captured hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers, even millions, really. The thing about Russia and the war, the invasion of Russia, is that they were dealing with such a massive scale, such an enormous country, that even though they achieved such incredible success up front, it still didn't have, it wasn't enough to really inflict a decisive final blow to Russia. And as one of the Germans said, you know, the Russians don't know when they're defeated. It goes on that because of these German strategic ideas, there were no geographical objectives given to the primary priority in the German plans. Secondary priority was given at Hitler's insistence to the capture of Leningrad in the north and to the capture of Kiev and the Caucasus to the south. This was a huge bone of contention between Hitler and his generals. And Hitler's generals, for the sake of honoring the humanity of their troops, they undermined Hitler on a few occasions with regards to these objectives. The German generals had disagreed with Hitler's geographic conceptions. They insisted that Moscow be made the chief geographical goal of the Germans' advance because it was the vital railroad center of European Russia. It was also an important industrial center and contained the heart and brain of the whole Soviet autocracy. And to anyone that reads that, they would agree with the German generals. Its capture would, according to the generals, cripple Russia's ability to shift troops and supplies north and south, and would thus make it possible to isolate for easier conquest the Leningrad or the Kiev fronts. Hitler ignored their advice for almost 9 months. In September 1941, when it was too late to take Moscow, only then did he change his mind. I was just thinking about the comment I made earlier with regards to Hitler being interchangeable with Chatham House, thinking about the Battle of Britain. There were so many coincidences regarding the bombing of London. You'll find it it's supposedly miraculous that all the key important locations, historical locations and important places within London were spared by the British bombing. The German bombing. It's so unlikely to occur without the bombers being specifically told not to or to avoid those areas. So there's a lot more going on than meets the eye. So as I mentioned before, has brought Germany into a war of attrition instead of fast victories. This war of attrition would have two fronts, which they could not afford. So an anti-Nazi German in Berlin gave a copy of Hitler's secret directive for Operation Barbarossa to the American commercial attaché within 3 weeks of its formulation. And this was sent to the Kremlin by Secretary of State Hull early in March 1941. All these helpful moves were received with ill grace by the Soviet leaders, and those who offered them were treated as troublemakers. Moscow made no effort to escape the Nazi pincers by withdrawing its forces from the exposed frontier positions, but continued to hope that its abject economic collaboration with Hitler would lead him to cancel the attack orders. That's incredible, reading that. There's definitely a lot more going on the scene, behind the scenes, that would lead to the Russians thinking that. In recognition of the fact that he could obtain more in an economic sense from collaborating in peace than from conquest and war, this hope was futile because Hitler had such a gigantic disrespect for Russia's fighting powers that he expected a complete German victory in about 6 weeks. Okay, there we go, 6 weeks. So convinced was Hitler on this point that he flatly rejected in June, again in July, and once again in August, suggestions from the chief of the great general staff that any preparations can be made for fighting in winter. And this was what cost Germany this battle. Hitler's estimates about the weakness of the Soviet armies and the brevity of the approaching campaign were generally shared by military men throughout the world. The armies, the attacking German armies, were arranged in a north-south line. You had the North Army, the Central Army, and the Southern Army. And Hitler was at odds with his staff with regards to where the fighting focus should be. Hitler wanted to go and hit Leningrad north, and he wanted the south. And he wasn't terribly interested in taking Moscow. After that disastrous period, he eventually agreed to take Moscow. So I'll just carry on reading here. Since the Russians had massed their strength in the south, the German army group south under Gerd von Rundstedt had only 800 tanks, while his Soviet opponent, Marshal S.M. Budani, had 2,000. The brilliant success of the German army group center led the German general staff and Hitler to change their minds, but in opposite directions. The weakness of the Soviet defense persuaded Bock to adopt a plan advanced by Guderian that Army Group Center abandon further efforts at pincer encirclements and send its armored units on a straight all-out drive to Moscow, 100 miles away. About the same time, Hitler decided to strengthen the advance of army groups north and south by directing the efforts of the two panzer armies of Army Group Center away from their own front and onto the fronts of the two flanking army groups. You see, it doesn't make any sense why he would do that unless he was speaking to other people and, in a sense, taking their advice. This would have left Army Group Center with infantry forces only, thus slowing its advance and restricting its operations to tactical mopping up activities, but would have increased the ability of the flanking army groups to close pincer envelopments by giving each of them the use of two panzer armies. So by directive number 33 on July the 19th, Hitler issued orders for this change. Although the generals resisted and stalled in carrying out these instructions, the advance on Moscow was broken. General Franz Halder wrote in his diary on June the 26th, "The Führer's analysis which at many points is unjustly critical of the field command, indicates a complete break with the strategy of large operational conceptions. And here we go. You cannot beat the Russians with operational successes, he argues, because they simply do not know when they are defeated. So he says it would be necessary to draw them in, destroy them bit by bit in small encircling areas of a purely tactical character. Against these ideas of Hitler, his generals argued for weeks in vain. On August 21st, Hitler issued Directive 34. It began, the proposals of the Army High Command for the continuance of the operation in the East, dated August 18th, do not conform to my intentions. The principal object is not the capture of Moscow. In place of this, it set the following objectives: to seize the Crimea and the Donbass coal mines, to cut off the Caucasian oil supplies, and to isolate Leningrad, to make direct contact with the Finns. As a result of the shift of emphasis to the south, German Army Group South completed a colossal envelopment east of Kiev. In a great bag, described as a bag, 200 miles wide, the Germans captured 665,000 prisoners, with 3,718 cannon and 884 tanks. Hitler, this is interesting, he called this the greatest battle in the history of the world. His chief of staff called it the greatest strategic blunder of the Eastern campaign. Here we get to the Ukraine. At this point in the campaign, a curious phenomenon appeared. Large members of anti-Stalinist Russians began to surrender to the Nazis. Most of these were Ukrainians. And they were also very, very eager to join the Germans and to fight the Nazis, to fight the Russians. And if the Nazis had been willing to cooperate with them, they were then able to use a very valuable group of people. Instead, the Nazis, led by Hitler, resolutely refused to adopt the role of liberator of the Slavs, and instead insisted on playing the role of annihilator of the Slavs. The arrogance, sadism, and racism of the Nazi system soon presented itself in a form as hateful to the average Slav as Stalinism itself. What happened to these people turned against the Russians, these Ukrainians, as despicable. They did use these Ukrainians to serve in the German forces, but they were given quite minor roles. And there was even a renegade Soviet general, A.A. Vlasov, who had served as a Soviet military advisor to Chiang Kai-shek in China with the rank of Major General. And he was willing to create a anti-Russian Ukrainian division to fight on the side of Hitler. They just had no use for him, except when the Germans were on the back foot and being served by the Russians, Himmler withdrew his opposition to this military force put together by Vlasov. Vlasov issued a call for an anti-Stalinist liberation army of Russians or Ukrainians. In 6 weeks, this organization received 1 million applications for membership. That's enormous. But could obtain almost no equipment and could organize combat units of no more than 50,000 men. At the end of the war, and this is the part I wanted to really highlight here, hundreds of thousands of Vlasov supporters fled westward to the American and British armies for refuge from Stalin's vengeance. Unbelievably, they were handed over to the Soviet Union to be murdered out of hand or sent to slave camps in Siberia. I put an enormous question, sorry, exclamation mark there. How sickening is that? It's unbelievable. The dimensions of human suffering involved in this whole situation is beyond the human imagination. The number of Soviet prisoners captured by the Nazis, according to the records of the German army, reached over 2 million by the 1st of November 1941 and reached 3,060,000 by March the 1st, 1942. Half a million of these died of starvation, typhus, or froze to death in prison camps in the winter of 1941 to 1942. In the whole Eastern campaign up to January 1944, the Nazis captured 5.5 million prisoners. This is just staggering numbers. Absolutely crazy, the human suffering. On September the 6th, 1941, in Directive Number 35, Hitler suddenly accepted the suggestions of his generals and ordered an attack on Moscow itself. After 2 weeks, the attacks began. About the same time, Leningrad was encircled, thus commencing an unsuccessful siege which continued until the city was relieved 28 months later. By October the 8th, 1941, two great encirclements west of Moscow closed on 663,000 Soviet prisoners with 5,412 cannon and 1,242 tanks. Mopping up took 2 weeks. And by that time, the weather had broken and the Germans were advancing through pouring rain, sleet, and mud. They suffered their first cases of frostbite on November the 7th, with Moscow only 38 miles away. This attack continued. I'm actually just reading a lot here, Melissa, because it sort of reads like a story. You can't really break too much from it. As winter took its toll on a winter unprepared German army and unprepared German vehicles, the Russian forces from the east then arrived, which triggered more and more frequent German withdrawals. By spring 1942, the Germans had been pushed back over 100 miles. The frostbite, 1,000 Germans per day were coming down with frostbite. And they lost, in that campaign, they lost 31% of their troops to the Russians. That's a million men. The Lend-Lease program was coming into effect, full effect. And we learn about how the Russians were aided by American and British Lend-Lease programs. They supplied boots, hardware, planes, weapons. Now that was the decisive turning of the war, where you came to a balance of powers. In September 1941, there was a mission headed by Avril Harriman and Lord Beaverbrook in Moscow for 3 days at the end of 1941. And there was an agreement signed for Soviet aid to June the 30th, 1942. This meeting was put together because it was decided that the Soviet Union would be able to hold out against the Nazi attack, so it would be worthwhile to assist them. In the post-war period, it was frequently stated that the Roosevelt administration should have taken advantage of Stalin's urgent need for supplies in September 1941 by forcing him to sign agreements to recognize the independence and territorial integrity of various countries in Eastern Europe. Strangely enough, whenever Quigley says things like bizarrely or strangely, or you know there's something more going on there. Strangely enough, during the discussions in Moscow at the time, Stalin was eager to obtain a formal statement on war aims and on specific territorial boundaries. But the United States was reluctant. It objected to any secret accords, in air quotes, which might hamper freedom of action later, and was unwilling either to abandon the peoples of Eastern Europe to Russia or to insist on their rights vigorously enough to drive the Soviet Union to make a separate peace with Hitler. Such a separate peace was quite out of the realm of possibility, but no agreements about boundaries and governments made in 1941 could have been enforced against the Soviet Union 4 years later, after these areas had fallen under Soviet military occupation. So, yeah, they had an opportunity to limit the footprint of Russia, and they didn't take that opportunity. The agreements of September the 30th, 1941, provided that in the next 9 months, the Anglo-Americans would send to the Soviet Union 1,050,000 tons of supplies, including 300 fighting planes, 100 bombers, and 500 tanks a month. Up to that moment, Russia had purchased about $100 million worth of supplies in the United States with its own money, had obtained $29 million in supplies from the United States alone, to be repaid in future, deliveries of gold bullion, and had obtained from Britain considerable supplies, including 450 planes, 3 million pairs of boots, and 22,000 tons of rubber. But financing the new Moscow Agreement was quite a different task and could be done only under Lend-Lease. I'm trying to recall something I read, but I think Britain only repaid its Lend-Lease debts to America in 2013 or something like that, or 2003, I forget. And the Russian Lend-Lease debt to America was paid off in 1970-odd. It wasn't the full payment, if I remember, and the rest was written off. So that's a little bit of trivia there. That's quite interesting.
I just looked up Britain. It said 2006.
2006, yeah.
Made its final payment on a multi-billion dollar loan. Amazing.
Yeah. It's quite incredible how this world is managed and run. It just finishes off with the way that how the problem was addressed with regards to delivery of these Lend-Lease goods to Russia. There were three general routes, and it ends off with the very sad part of the northern route, which was destined for the sea route to Murmansk or Archangel. And in that part of the world, you generally have daylight 24 hours a day. So the poor old Russians were bombed 24 hours a day in that area as they were trying to receive these goods. The horrors of this northern route to Russia are almost beyond description. In the summer, 24 hours of light each day, allowed attacks to be continuous. In the winter, water temperature was so low that torpedoed seamen could survive no more than a few minutes. And in both seasons, there was no relief at the end of the voyage, for the Russian ports were within easy bombing range of German air bases under conditions of visibility. That's how it ends. And it's particularly grim. I am really, really interested in the part with regards to the Russians or the Ukrainians who were willing to fight on the side of the Nazis. The Germans wanted nothing to do with them anyway. So it is interesting that in the lead up to the Ukrainian maiden event, you had so much neo-Nazi type very far right groups that were pushing for the overthrow of the Lukashenko, who was in favor of doing business with Russia. And yet the Russians really wanted nothing to do with the Russians themselves who lived within the Ukraine. Because, you know, in the eastern Ukraine, you've got those autonomous, Russian autonomous regions that are predominantly Russian, not Ukrainian. But even then, Putin didn't really have much interest in them because historically they were anti-Stalin. And it's actually what's been done to the Ukraine is to instigate one group against the other, like a civil war, and then to invite the Americans to use the Russian response as a proxy war against Russia. And the people that are going to lose the most are the Russian Ukrainians and the Ukrainian Ukrainians. It's being used as a catalyst to draw in the superpowers to transform Europe and even the world. And if we've learned anything from Quigley, it's not to believe the narrative as it's produced to us via the mainstream media, because the mainstream media is a column of the establishment that it's an arm of government. And what the people are told about an event or a war or the reasons for anything are normally completely the opposite or something completely different. So if you are following RT News or the BBC or CNN and getting regular feedback and following this conflict very closely, just bear in mind that you're getting pure propaganda. And then again, you have very interesting talking heads on YouTube. Some of them seem to be a lot more honest than others. But even then, be careful, because it's not really about, the war isn't about what you see. It's not about necessarily about Russia wanting to keep NATO off its frontier. Putin himself is very much on board with the globalist planning for international governance. The role he's playing at the moment is just a role. And they will engineer a set of opposite forces to probably realign the European and Eurasian frontiers for this three-block system that we've learned about. And that three-block system has probably, well, it hasn't gone away, and it's just on the next stage of its development. And with that, I would like to end tonight and then go to bed. It's 11:30, and we've been going, Melissa, for, what's that, 8, 9, 10, 3.5 hours.
Thank you both very much. That was an absolute marathon session. There's no doubt about it. Good night.
Thank you. Thanks for hanging on. That was a marathon. And on top of my insomnia, I think my brain is starting to, well, it was starting to crash about an hour ago. So thank you all.
Well, I did a little messaging with Andrea, and we agreed that in 2 weeks we want to start an hour earlier.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, hopefully we can go swifter next time, but it takes what it takes.
Yeah, but thank you very much. It was really interesting. Learned a lot tonight, so thank you.
Thanks, Fiona. Thanks for being here and hanging out, listening.
Yeah, that was. I just want to add. I think when Melissa got cut out there, I just got. I actually muted you to listen to somebody else, so I must have admin rights. So I apologize for that. It must have been me because it coincided with me muting you about Alex Salmond dying with a heart attack. Sorry.
Oh, no problem. I think probably everybody was grateful for a little break.
Yeah,
Melissa, it was about the word. Emphatically was the last I heard before you were muted, so you did catch where you'd started, so it was okay.
Okay, good.
Okay, good night, everybody.
Good night, Fiona.
Thanks for hanging on.